Since 2022, SaaS companies have faced intense pressure to become more profitable. Obviously, infrastructure costs are a significant piece to the SaaS company cost structure. Today, we will speak to an expert that helps SaaS companies reduce those costs. I am Thomas Law, the Executive Director of the Technology and Services Industry Association. And welcome to Tectonic, the podcast where we explore what makes technology business models successful in today's world. And today, I will be having a conversation with Claire Milligan, who is the CEO of Aimably, a firm specializing in helping companies reduce their spend on cloud infrastructure. So let's get the insight engine humming here. Welcome, Claire, to Tectonic. It's great to meet you. It's the first time we've had a chance to meet, but I've heard you on other podcasts, and it caught my ear, and I thought you'd be a great guest for our audience here. So why don't we start here? Can you just provide an overview of the services that your company provides?
Sure. Thanks so much for having me, Thomas. And I appreciate that you reached out. This is going to be fun. At Aimably, we provide software and services to help companies understand what they're spending on the cloud and then also control it. Our service portfolio ranges from a SaaS offering to help accountants translate AWS spend into accounting bookkeeping entries. And then mostly what we spend our time doing right now are a lot of customer engagements where we use our software to identify and uncover a lot of opportunities for savings that align with business strategy.
So one of our member companies is EY. And I think it's going to be hard to be a service or consulting company without a piece of software as part of it. So that's what you already put on the table, that you have a SaaS offering to help augment or help deliver the value proposition. I mean, there's going to be a time where there'd be no such thing as having consulting services that don't have some underlying technology that enable that. So that's cool. So TSI, the audience knows here, we have been studying the financial models of SaaS companies for years and years and years. And I want to start by just getting a baseline or benchmark out there for the audience to think about. As a percentage of revenue, if you're a SaaS company, roughly, what do you think they should be spending on their core infrastructure costs, right? The technology required to support the offer.
To answer that question, we have to get a little bit deeper into where we're actually looking. There's often some concern about what is infrastructure cost. Yeah. So it can come in the form of, what are we talking about the whole bill? Are we talking about the portion that's attributable to cost of goods sold? And are we including expenses that are from beyond the engineering organization? So those numbers are going to shift. We're looking straight at the P&L and we're seeing revenue and then cost of goods sold to get a net revenue number. You don't want to be above 10% of your revenue, because you're not going to be able to make the kind of target 75% gross margin goal that is generally held in SaaS if you don't stay under that number. But that being said, a lot of times firms are booking these costs a little bit incorrectly because it's very difficult to tell from the bill what exactly this is for. And so you'll often find R&D costs accidentally up there. Sometimes you'll see all the cost of goods sold way down in R&D. So the question is, first, clean it up and make sure everything's right. And then let's target for the 10% up top.
So let's just click into that baseline, because this is, I think, a really interesting number. So we track this index we have called the TSI Cloud 40. We track 40 of the largest publicly traded born in the cloud companies, and their average gross margin, so that would be revenue minus COGS, which should include the core infrastructure cost, right? Plus any free services and other things they're doing to enable that. So that's been running around 68 to 70% is the gross margin, right? So it's about, let's say, 30% of cost on the table. So what you just said is, hey, if that 30% is a benchmark, no more than 10% of that should be the true core infrastructure cost.
Yes. And there's a couple of reasons why. This is a benchmark from our standpoint, from how we work with other companies, not necessarily the averages, right? The reason why is that the billing model runs in a very scaled, where the idea is you only pay for what you use. So there's this belief that we're getting billed for what we use, and therefore there's nothing we can do to change it. And the truth of the matter is there's a lot you can do to change it. A lot of it is just based on stuff you've bought and you're not using. And so we find that there's always so much to be cut that once we do, these businesses change dramatically. Our specialty is actually to work with companies that are owned by private equity, because not only is there the economic push, but there's a serious driver towards a new operational model within the next 5 to 7 years. So we'll say, hey, where we are now. And so we'll work with these firms to make sure that everyone in their portfolio is meeting those benchmarks and getting to that nice position so that the exit will be great. So that's one of the reasons why we have a little bit more of an aggressive benchmark, because we know it's doable. It's not necessarily common.
So now you put another really interesting thread on the table I have to click into. So we have a lot of member companies that are owned by PE, or they're taken private, right? They're probably taken private. And our experience is that these PE firms come in, they go, well, we know what the benchmarks are. We know what your gross margin should be in professional services. We know how much revenue should come from CSR. And what we find, unfortunately, is that the benchmarks are not crystal clear or not really where they should be. So I'm just curious, when you're going after that infrastructure cost, again, obviously the PE firms are like, hey, help us take out costs or interest in that. But the numbers that you're going after, my gut is your data is probably much more realistic and also achievable or actionable than maybe whatever they had in mind at the beginning. I'm just guessing that. What is your experience when you are working with the PE firms?
Yeah, that is definitely our experience. In fact, we have worked with companies from Series A, scale, all the way through to a recent take private off the NASDAQ. And they never, in our entire experience, have we found less than 20% savings available. So if you think about what you're spending and then how that fits your car, like, you can really easily back out of that. Yeah. And when we talk about savings, we're not talking about, I want to be super crystal clear, we're not talking about rewriting your software. There are cases where we'll discover in an infrastructure conversation with the team, I'll bring one as a recent example, where they are aware that there are many versions behind of a specific engine. And so being able to introduce this new scaling technique, let's say, they'd have to upgrade those. So what we do in our analysis is we'll actually say, okay, so here's the version you're on, here's the version you need to be, these are the kind of resources that would be required, how long might that take, how much might that cost, and then let's add on the value of this upgrade, and then let's consider this as a whole, instead of just saying, no, we just can't do that. So what we find then is that these are jobs that are doable and they pay back, and we see very high numbers. The 20% is just the floor.
So I'm curious, the second question I had for you is around this range. So let's say ideally you're spending 10% on your infrastructure costs. I have to imagine there's a massive range though when you go in, you know, so how high and what's the low? I'm just curious what you've seen.
You know, to be honest with you, not everyone shares their revenue numbers with us until afterwards. We try to create our benchmarks after we start working, because sometimes people are a little embarrassed.
Yeah.
We do see more towards the 20% of engagements. But here's actually how the conversation goes. The leader from the private equity company usually says, hey, let's look at these guys. This is like where we feel they are against the benchmark, and we think that it could change a little bit. And then we talk to the technology leader and they say, oh, no. The numbers are actually this. And so what happens is that there's definition differences. And honestly, I'm not there to arbitrate. I'm there to make sure that the CTO looks great. Like, I, you know, facilitate that person, their teams, like, let's get it done. And oftentimes what we try to do is actually also provide a decent amount of education, because what you get in the bill is not necessarily the financial charges. Like, you need to think about the amortization across of the lifetime of a reserved instance if you buy it ahead of time, and whether or not you're pulling out those marketplace charges. And so there's a lot of financial thought that has to go into identifying what your actual cloud spend is.
What you're describing is exactly what we go through on the service side. It's exactly the same thing. So someone will come to us and they'll say, well, our CFO wants us to have, you know, 60% gross margin on our consulting offers because that's what they think is good. And they'll put some business version of the model on the table and say, well, we have benchmarks, but by the way, we have to have a common definition here. So once you start moving stuff around, you say, okay, now we are comparing apples to apples compared to what good looks like in the industry. But that translation part is so key, but it's never failed to amaze me that we'd think with accounting rules that you'd see pretty much the same thing from company to company. The variance that you can see on where people stick stuff. Oh, like you were saying, oh, that ended up in G&A. Oh, that ended up in R&D. Well, wait a minute. That is up in cost of service. It's kind of crazy when you look at it.
It is. And honestly, what I like to do is go back to first principles of why are we doing what we're doing? Like, why is it booking to where it is? What are we communicating in our business? Like, there's strategy behind this, right? And the best CFOs think that way. But I mean, not to take a slight little deviation, but I've got a little bit of a bone to pick with our whole big gross margin model and perspective on the tech industry, because we spend all of our engineering focus on building features that satisfy customer requests. And isn't that the definition of cost of goods sold, to be able to deliver to a client contract in a traditional sense? So are we really that great? Should we be putting all those salaries up top? I don't know.
I totally agree with that. And this is another question I want to ask you about how things have changed. But I've met with plenty of an executive team who it's like, look, what do we care about at a SaaS company? We want to have a great growth number, and we want to have a really good looking gross margin number. We have a high gross margin business, and everything else we don't have to really worry about, right? So you can take costs and stuff them down in R&D. I've seen free services that end up in G&A, right? And so, hey, yeah, okay, we're 30 points underwater, OI, operating income. But look at this killer gross margin, which is this completely false positive number. Now, what I'm seeing pre-2022, these expenses were all over the place. Also, I found that a lot of SaaS companies, when you ask them questions like, for example, what percentage of revenue do you spend on free support services or free customer success services? They kind of go, well, they're not really sure. And I'm curious, are you seeing much more discipline now around the cost structure and post-2022, where they're like, okay, before we didn't really know, now we have to know? Is that your experience?
Yes, with a little bit of an asterisk. The role that's getting hired for right now, which is a great role, is called FinOps. And really, it's the merging between understanding how we're spending in the cloud and how we're reporting it. And it's so important. But, you know, I actually wrote an article about this. I feel like FinOps people are now stuck in this position where they're screaming into the wind. They're saying, dig here, look here, this is the solution. Why don't we go and do something here? This is actually how it's supposed to be booked, whatever it is. But we've hired people mm-hmm. who are significantly junior enough, yeah. but deadly enough with their technical knowledge that we just expect them to run spreadsheets and give us results and not really pay attention to what they're recommending. And they're not really an engineer. They don't really know what they're doing. They're not really in finance, but they don't really know what they're doing. And so we're kind of in this weird eddy where there's a focus. We hired a person, but are we actually getting to where we want to be?
So this phenomenon of FinOps has started more recently. You're saying this capability for companies to have it in place?
It's become much more popular recently. The FinOps Foundation got started, I want to say 15 years ago. But those who are much more involved than I will be able to correct me. But the discipline has been around and very necessary from the moment that the cloud was born. When we get billed by a cloud infrastructure provider, we're billed on the basis of the services that we receive from them. That's inherited from data center days. And it's fine to get a list of charges by server, because in the data center days, when we thought about this, one server did this thing and one server did that thing. And it's very logical one-to-one relationship. And in fact, if you went to the lumber yard, you get billed by 2x4s. But when it comes to AWS or Azure or GCP, when they tell you, here is how much you spend in virtual machines, you're like, for what? You know, like, there's a huge question there. And it's been that way since the beginning. So the very thoughtful companies have been involved in understanding that for quite a while, and the rest of us are all catching up.
Also, what I'm hearing is they're having their moment now. I mean, they should be having their moment now. It's like you have to beef up that capability, make sure you have the right skill set in there to do the job that they're chartered to do, because it's such an important job. That's fascinating. So let's talk about some of these different cost components that go into hosting a SaaS application. You just mentioned you got all these virtual machines flying around. So when you go in there, what are the big buckets that you're looking at?
So our approach is we take utilization data of all the services. We take individual billing data for all the services, which tend to be hour by hour, resource by resource, very detailed, and then pricing models. And so for every service that you're spending more than, gosh, I forget what our threshold is now. I think it's 5% of your bill. For every service that you spend above that level, we're going to go in and we're going to triangulate the utilization and the billing against all the pricing models that are available to you. And the pricing models may not necessarily just be like, hey, I want to switch from monthly billing to weekly billing, but it might be if you implement this additional feature, then that can have an effect on your pricing. So for example, in AWS S3 and also Blob Storage and Azure, there's tiering models where they'll put stuff into archive that is cheaper over time. And so that would be an example of a different billing model that could reap rewards based on your behavior. So we'll say, well, maybe this one is good for it because you're not pulling stuff out as frequently, but this one we modeled over here and it's not good for it. And here's why. So in doing so, like, where we focus when you're talking about the buckets then is we see companies in kind of three stages of maturity. And especially the ones that have been larger and are being brought together or taken private, or they traditionally are seeing a lift and shift, meaning they're operating servers as if they were in the data center. They needed to move to AWS. They made that decision for a structural standpoint, but the business is still operating as if it were capital expenditures. And there's just bloat in straight up servers. And there's so much you can do with fixing that. Then there's the middle, which is kind of managed service zone, which we think about as they're using a managed database. They're using some technology to connect that with servers. They might be putting things in containers and Kubernetes. And then the way that we find savings there is tuning the best use of those things, because that often will be a situation where those folks don't have a ton of experience or just relied on what they did 10 years ago, 5 years ago, and today. And then the third is what we talk about, like a fully cloud native, the world of serverless, the world of batch operations. You know, I don't need a server at all, bring them up when I need them. And that is incredibly good for tying spend to your actual utilization. However, there's so many ways to fine tune these things that make it actually more performant and much better cost, because the last thing you need to do is scale things up too late and then be paying for too much to make sure that it doesn't get to the right time. So those are the buckets that we see, and it depends on the maturity.
And so the maturity, that third profile there, is probably the one that is ideally the most just-in-time model, should be the most optimized. But even there, you're saying there's some opportunities to do some fine-tuning. Did I get that?
Yeah, my favorite is AWS Batch. It's one of the ones that I love. You put stuff in a container, throw it at a job queue. It runs only when it's needed. Fantastic. But one of the settings they have is pick your instance type, and you can say optimal. You're like, great, optimal, how wonderful. They only choose from three different instance types that are all 5 years old or older. So it's like, well, that's not optimal. Like, come on. So there's all kinds of different ways of that.
You have quite the sort of algebra equation there, triangulating between everything that's going on, between the pricing and what's available. So there's a lot of moving parts there to do the analysis, it sounds like.
Yeah. If we didn't have software to do this, it would be a big lift.
When you look at those cost components, are there any commonly present low-hanging fruit opportunities for optimization when you go, where you're like, I can almost 100% guarantee there's going to be bloat on dot, dot, dot?
Yeah, scaling. And whether it is scaling for databases or scaling for groups of servers running the same workload in either Kubernetes or just straight EC2 or virtual machines, we see that there's a fundamental distrust or confusion, I'll say that, between software engineering and DevOps. Like, you have to cross this Rubicon if you're going to be accepting the fact that an instance could show up, a server could show up and go away, and your application would continue performing. And the original old school way of saying it was, I know the IP address of that server, and I'm going to talk to that IP address. And so we've changed over time, we've abstracted away from it. And there's this final point where oftentimes engineering just doesn't trust and doesn't necessarily want to put the cycles in to make sure that you can handle an instance coming online for 4 minutes and then going away. And it can and it should. And once you do that, you unlock an incredible amount of savings. And that happens with databases and it happens with virtual servers. And then once you do that, you can add spot instance. There's all kinds of stuff you can do, but you just have to be able to get past that point of trust. And oftentimes it involves just taking out certain workloads and putting them somewhere else.
Again, this is well beyond my expertise in this area, but I am really fascinated by this. Just playing that back. Again, properly architected, the full advantage of the cloud is literally this just-in-time concept where it's like, I need this for a moment or whatever, and it goes away. And so I should be architecting that way, writing code that way, et cetera. And what you're saying is that they're still in the industry, even though cloud has been around for all these years, that there's still, from an engineering perspective, development perspective, that's not always embedded in the thinking in terms of how they're actually architecting the product. And so they can't take advantage of that. Is that fair?
Yeah. And I think that really, especially when we're talking about businesses that are really changing their economics right now, they've been around for a minute, you know? And so that technology wasn't necessarily trusted for a while. Certain releases didn't necessarily go well. And so, you know, let's just stick with coding what we know as of 7 years ago, and then coding what we knew as of 7 years ago is just not to that standard now.
Again, very fascinating to me, because what you're on here is part of what we call this as a service transformation that so many legacy software companies have had to go through, right? So they've been around, like you say, for longer than a hot minute. They've got tons of stuff deployed, right? And now they have to start moving their portfolio to SaaS. And we spent a lot of time on that transition on the financial modeling of that, because you're going from transactional to recurring, and you have to now care about renewals with customers. You have to care about adoption. So there's a whole big business model change that goes on there. And what you're saying is, obviously, we know that there's a technology change, but I've heard CEOs at companies say, oh yeah, we just need to go SaaSify that legacy application, right? It's like we waved this wand, right? And it's been SaaSified. And what you're putting on the table is, hey, besides all the business model stuff that's going to break, that underneath that, you probably have an entire product development team that this is a completely different bag of tricks and skill set to really get the optimal benefits cost-wise out of the cloud. And you should not be underestimating that. You can't just go, oh, yeah, just go SaaSify that. And so there's some real headroom there. So even if maybe they SaaSified several years ago and they're like, oh yeah, we got it running out there, there's probably some real headroom there in terms of optimizing what they've done.
Absolutely. One of our clients that we're working on, we're finalizing right now, recently moved out of a data center, and they decided that we're going to move first and we're going to improve later. Makes sense. So they moved out of where they had had all the current storage, all the files that needed to be accessed. They were stored locally on the actual server that was running the logic, and it was constantly being copied back and forth from a shared array. So in order to do that, they actually had to implement a file system in the cloud that would then mount and copy across regions globally and copy all these files down onto the local disk of these virtual machines to replicate what it was happening right next to each other in the data center. They were spending like $200,000 a month to make sure that this would happen in exchange for not having done the application changes to allow for the references to go beyond the local drive. And you think about that and you're like, wait, okay, an engineer costs that a year. Could we solve this with less than 12 engineers? Probably. So why don't we go do that? But we don't think about this cost. We think about it just in terms of, hey, I've got engineers, they've got to build stuff for customers, and we can think about that later. That's a huge problem.
And we've written about this. When you watch companies go from a traditional on-premise model, right, with their technology, and they say, okay, I've got to start moving. I know that the models are going to AR, you know, recurring revenues. Customers want to buy that way. I know eventually I got to get the stuff in the cloud. What we see is that there's sort of three moves on the chessboard. And you're seeing this, I think, clearly on the technology side. So the first one is they just changed their pricing model. So the customer still has on-prem, right? They just say, oh, you're now renewing recurring revenue.
That's like the Adobe model. All of a sudden, everything's subscription, but it's the same.
Yeah, it's the same. And they go to the street and they go, look at me. I'm just like one of these cool cloud companies, but they're really not yet. Okay, so that's the first move on the chessboard. The second one, and I was just on a call with a member last week who's eating through this challenge here, is you start putting customers in what we call a managed posture, which is what you describe, which is, okay, I'm going to port my stuff sort of to the cloud. I'll manage it for the customer, but it's really an instance of one. You know, I just kind of took everything that they had on premise. I moved it in the cloud. And really, it's a managed service is what it is. It's not multi-tenant cloud. It's not really SaaS, right? And so then they pop a bunch of these up and they got all these running, and that becomes really expensive really quick. That is not a 75% gross margin business. That is like, if you're lucky, a 55, 60% gross margin business, right? So then they go, well, we really want to get customers to multi-tenant, right? So then they make that move. And what you put is a fourth move on the chessboard is, even if you, once you get there, there's probably some optimization you can do to really get that true SaaS multi-tenant really optimal. So it is a multi-year journey. And what kind of blows me away, because again, we've been tracking this for years and years and years now, you would think after all these years that SaaS and cloud has been in play, that as an industry, we would have optimized the shit out of this model. And what you're saying is, no, maybe not so much. And what we know is that, again, we have all these software companies in these different postures, right? Still eating through this transformation from disconnected on-prem transactional to truly in the cloud, truly optimized from a cost perspective to get this model to sync from the software provider's perspective, right? To make it as profitable as possible.
Yeah. And in that road, it becomes wildly unprofitable. So the question is, when is the right time for us to be able to do this? Sometimes sticking with on-prem and just having a license situation may give you the funds to build an alternative as SaaS rather than trying to shove your system into containers and hoping they run somewhere.
Yeah, I know, I agree. But back to the earlier PE conversation, right? So here's another painful reality that we're seeing is, so companies who are still relatively early in this journey, so maybe they changed the pricing model. So now they say, look, I've got a bunch of annual recurring revenue, but underneath the covers, they still have a lot of this technical journey to go through. And the PE firm comes in at that point in time and says, well, you know, your stock price is kind of stalling and your revenues might be slowing down or whatever. We're going to take you under the covers. We're going to clean up your cost structure and we're going to spit you back up. But now part of the cost structure issue is that you actually have to complete the thought. If you want to come out and be a true SaaS company, right, and really be competitive with a modern day architecture, you got some work to do yet. And of course, that doesn't always work into the PE model. Like our motto is cut costs. Our motto is not to invest here. So I have to believe you see that friction.
Yes. But you'll see that the most savvy technology investors understand that it's not worth it to bring forward the very legacy pieces. So what you'll see them doing is they'll acquire a cloud native product that doesn't have the market positioning and doesn't have the sales backing behind it, but it's totally scalable. And then they'll move people. So they'll acquire it, put it together, and have you move everyone. A great example that's happening right now is their PaperTrail was used forever for logging. It was bought by SolarWinds a long time ago, merged together. There were a whole lot of things. And now they're finally pushing everyone off of it. And so you'll see that much more aggressively in PE.
It's basically, you have to go to those legacy customers and say, here's the new model. We hope that you're going to move to it. But if you're not, you know, we got to move on because we got to get all the customers. That makes a lot of sense. So the other question I want to ask you is just about surprises. So as you've gone into these companies, what are some of the most surprising things you encountered in terms of the infrastructure, the costs? I'm just curious.
The example of the drive copying around the world was quite something recently. But, you know, honestly, on a human level, I can't tell you how many resources that we see in our reports. So our tool spits out reports, and then it's up to us to take those and determine if they make the most sense for the business and what are their prerequisites. And so it's the financial structure underneath whether or not we want to recommend this implementation, right? So we get these reports, and you'll look at them, and it'll just say server names. It'll say things like test, delete me, don't turn off. Like, these are the names of these things, right? And you're like, what? I didn't come from the engineering side. I came from product design, and I actually moved through and was running a line of business. And the whole reason why I got here in the first place is because I was supposed to turn my growth business into a cash cow so that we could fund growth in other areas of the company that had been pushed together with acquisition, right? And so I knew what I needed to do, and I just couldn't. I couldn't do anything about this infrastructure. So my business partner and I got into business and doing what we're doing. So it's not like I'm familiar with this stuff. And I started seeing this and I was like, Mark, what's going on? He's like, oh, that's just engineer.
Well, I have to ask this other question about the tagline of your company, which states that you have a new approach to AWS cost management guaranteed to delight any accountant. So that really struck my eyes. Put the story on the table there. What does that mean?
Whether you're talking about investors, CFOs, operational leaders, people are examining a business by looking at the financial statements. Ultimately, they are coming at it from an accounting lens. That's the basis for which you'll sell your business. That's the basis for which you'll go public if you are ending up that direction. And so when we're thinking about making a business better, it's going back to what you were talking about. It's talking about the gross margins, making sure you're just not flushing cash out the back door, all those kinds of things. So we start from that standpoint and we say, your financial statements are what they are. We're going to make them better. And here's why. And so every time we onboard a new client, we actually run all the engineers through a little bit of a boot camp on how to read a P&L and how their expense hits the P&L and what that means for the business. And so that perspective then brings anybody who's from a finance background immediately into a position of calm because they know that this is not just another fishing expedition. And this is not just a tool that people want to buy. And there's real direct value. And that's ultimately one of the core decision-making processes for working with a company like ours versus going in-house is what kind of results are we going to get? And do they make sense for transforming our business? For an example, like there's some tools that focus just on getting you really cheap spot instances for your engineering workloads. For instance, sounds great, wonderful, but that's all R&D costs. That's not going to address your gross margin at all. So should we be focusing there? You know, we start that conversation and end that conversation with a financial statement.
Back to what we were talking about earlier about sort of just common definitions, how is the P&L structured? It sounds like you are doing some foundational education work there with a lot of these companies to say, and again, this really resonates with me because we see the same thing on the service side of the house, right? And so you're saying, look, this is really how you should be thinking about these buckets. This is really what's up in cost of service. This is what really is our R&D. But the finance people need that. They ultimately need that clarity. And so I can see the value of that and connecting the reality of what engineering and product people are dealing with and what finance needs to deal with, understand, and reconcile the P&L. And that's fantastic. So that makes sense to me. So I have to ask you, because I'm intellectually curious. So you look out in the marketplace in terms of providing cloud infrastructure, you've got Microsoft, you've got Google, you have AWS or the big dogs. And I'm just curious, do you see that marketplace evolving with more providers? Or there's this theory of the classic rule of three, right? Markets always kind of end up with like three big companies that sort of own the vast majority of market share. Do you think that that's where that market has landed and it's stable? Or just what are your thoughts?
It was until everyone decided they needed to be an AI company.
Yeah.
What you'll hear a lot in the news is, but do they have the compute? That's the question. And so when you're running large language models and you're training them, you need an incredible amount of GPU. And that's not necessarily available as plentifully as we would like to imagine with the top three. So you're starting to see Oracle coming in. And so people are going to be doing a lot of their machine learning over at Oracle. We'll see how that pans out. I mean, I know Microsoft, Google, and AWS are focusing entirely on very technical hardware solutions to be able to make sure that Oracle's not successful. So we'll see. But I would say that up until a year ago, yeah, I would have said absolutely, that's the three. It might change.
Do you think that the need for AI processing, do you think that will force some companies to, in a sense, not go to a service provider, but just stand up the infrastructure themselves? Just say, like, I'm going to secure stuff myself and just do it.
Yeah. Yes, it can, especially the larger ones. I mean, I can't imagine, you know, a business as large as, let's say, Apple, not doing it on their own infrastructure because of the cost basis. I mean, it becomes an energy cost, really, for them at that point.
Final question, because you already mentioned AI, but I have to ask this of everybody. So does AI change the equation for SaaS infrastructure cost in any way? Does it help companies optimize it? Are there new tools in the tool bag, or is it not relevant?
It is, but it's part of a larger question that we all have to ask ourselves about whether or not we need all of the components of our software to be proprietary. We think a lot about intellectual property. Our model of fundraising in venture capital back 20 years has been, how fast are you growing and what's your moat of other people being able to build what you have? And as technology businesses become not these sideshows and every business becomes a technology business, you have to realize that we all use shared software solutions and techniques to run, you know, sales teams. And so why are we spending our time and our very precious engineering resources creating bespoke software solutions to basic challenges that everybody's facing? And so when it comes to AI, there's these core models that are starting to grow. And your basic question here is, do we build our own or do we build on top of an existing one? And I would say the smart, savvy, forward-thinking business person is going to think a lot more, and technology person from a business perspective is going to be thinking a lot more about aggregating the use of subcomponents in order to build their software, because those are totally controllable and don't require a really high-quality engineer to just do ongoing maintenance on, which is really a travesty, I think.
I'll put a couple things on the table. I mean, I think I've said it on this podcast 100 times. I mean, AI is definitely going to disrupt technology business models in terms of how we operate, right? So AI is changing the way we develop software. It's changing the way we deliver services. It's changing every aspect of the business, right? Tons of workflow applications. So it really is going to change our operating models. It is going to take out a lot of cost in terms of labor hours. It just is. But I also wonder what AI does to the software industry in general. And is it a commoditizing factor. And what I mean by that, so if you're a software company and you say, I provide CRM software or whatever software, it's feature functionality, it does these things, right? You used to be able to charge a lot for that, right? That value proposition, I think, is going to get eviscerated by AI. And I think that the value, if you're a technology solution provider, you're going to have to climb up the stack and have a different value proposition and say, look, I'm going to leverage software. I'm going to leverage new AI capabilities. I'm going to leverage understanding about your business. And I'm going to have very different value conversations with you. But if I'm just showing up, showing you my shiny widget of features, I don't care if it's fully optimized in the cloud or not, I think that value proposition is going to be under pressure. But we'll see.
I agree. I think it has been for a while. I think people who try to sell on the basis of feature sets have struggled for a while, because we think about, when we're trying to determine the value of a purchase, we think about solving our own problems and what we're doing in our world, and not necessarily whether or not we'll like the mobile app. I think that if you categorize software solutions into questions of resolving business issues, there's still core efficiency issues. If I'm trying to be a salesperson and maintain my book of business, it's a lot easier for it to be in a CRM, even if the CRM is just a little bit better than spreadsheets. I mean, I'm not a huge fan of most CRMs, right? Mm-hmm. But that efficiency gives you a very clear business value. Yep. It's the step up from there where we're talking about analytics solutions or even big data solutions where they're like, hey, put all your stuff here. It's Snowflake. It's great. And you can run any query you want. Well, should I be deciding what query I need to run? Shouldn't the AI find things, surface them for me? Couldn't they replace the person who's trying to come up with all the different functions? I think in those cases where it's less the actual rote efficiency, it's like a step up from there. You're right. I think those business models will evaporate.
Well, Claire, I really appreciate you coming in today. Super fun conversation. And I always end this podcast with a question of the day for the audience. And so my question is very simple. If you're out there and you have a SaaS application in play, are your infrastructure costs optimized? Claire, thanks again so much for coming. Cheers, everybody.